lasso. This morning we return to that little theme called human agency. And we have a whole morning for it, to figure this one out. It's very easy to leap to the conclusion, and a profoundly, devastatingly incorrect conclusion, that there is no human agent. There's no one in here at all. And why? Oh, but I can hear it. Can you turn it up a little bit? I think it's good now, yes? In the back? Not quite. Can we have a bit more volume? I could hear it, but it wasn't as loud as it was before. How is it now? Jolly good. Thank you, David. Thank you. Oh, yeah. So I was referring to a devastatingly incorrect conclusion that there simply is no one in here at all. There's no agent. There is no person controlling the attention. One might think that that's where this is supposed to be directed, that, you know, look, 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 you don't find it. Ah, I got it. There's no one here. Padmasambhava returns to this theme in the very next section of the text, Natural Liberation. And he challenges that assumption by saying, if you look in there and then you see, ah, there's no one here, then ask yourself, who said that? You know? And so, a very profound point, and it's subtle, but it's enormously important, is that you as an agent are every bit as existent, as real as your brain. No less real. Anger is no less real than a rifle, than a gun. It's no less real. Anger has done far more damage in the world than guns ever have, because anger was around long before guns were. Guns just sit there and rust. Or they're picked up and used for target practice. Anger picks them up and then starts wreaking havoc. So the point here is not that there's no agent, that there is simply no one who is releasing and inverting the awareness. It's a very easy conclusion to draw, and I'm finding more and more extremely superficial parallels drawn between certain themes in modern psychology, neuroscience, and Buddhism. It looks like another book is coming out. It's going to be called something like The Illusion of the Self. And it's written by a neuroscientist. And I'm sure he's going to say, you see, Buddhism is saying this, and now we are too, but we really know what we're talking about because we are scientists. And there's no self. It's just, you know, it's just the brain. There's no one in charge. It's just, and there's no part of the brain that is the CEO of the brain. It's just a whole bunch of neural networks engaging in interaction with each other, with the body, the environment. And you see, isn't that marvelous? It's all one. That is a false facsimile of the Buddhist insight into emptiness, and specifically the emptiness of the self. Profoundly false facsimile. And moreover, when neuroscientists, psychologists, and philosophers of mind do this, almost invariably, they're saying, you see, the self is an illusion, will is an illusion, choice is an illusion, because the brain is doing everything before you even think about it, and so you're just along for the ride, except you don't really exist, so you're not even along for the ride. If this sounds like cutting-edge neuroscience, we should be aware that this is exactly what William James was being taught in the 1860s when he was going to medical school at Harvard, that you are just a biological organism and there's nothing more to you than that. 1860s, right after the Civil War. This is not cutting-edge science. This is old, old materialism, tracing back to Democritus with a modern mask. William James, as I just was checking up on this, William James, note his biography. It's quite an interesting biography, an extraordinary man. Very complex, in some ways very troubled. Had a very delicate nervous system, had a lot of lung, a definite major lung disorder. In terms of his nervous system, very fragile, very, very delicate, extremely sensitive, and was prone to depression even as a child. But when he went through this medical training, which was absolutely reductionistic, and which he's been being taught by his professors at Harvard, even back then they had some credibility, you know, some authority, you are just a biological organism. He just went into a tailspin. He struggled with depression throughout his whole medical training. By the time he finished, he almost went catatonic. He was just about catatonic. He went into a depression. He describes, and it's actually his own first-person experience, in the varieties of religious experience. And it was just like falling into hell, like a dark hell, a black hell of catatonia. He was utterly disabled. And my response, I read about this years ago when I was at Stanford, was good for you, James. Right on. That is a realistic response. That's a realistic response. If you are nothing more than a biological organism, your very sense of being anybody at all is purely an illusion. You don't make any choices at all. And you're taking that to heart. The realistic response is catatonic depression. Good on you. It completely disabled him. And then, in about 1870, about a year after he got his medical degree, he read some writings by the French philosopher Charles Renouvier on freedom of will, pointing out that there was simply not sufficient scientific evidence or any other kind of evidence to demonstrate unequivocally that the self doesn't exist, that we don't make choices, that we don't have some meaningful freedom of choice, and that the evidence simply is not compelling to refute that possibility. William James read this in the midst of his depression, and that inspired him to pull out of the indoctrination, the brainwashing that he had at Harvard, and he made this famous statement, "My first act of free will is to assert that I have it." So when I encounter, and I do encounter a lot of people in psychology, philosophy of mind, and neuroscience who are quite contentedly affirming the notion that we are just brains, I think, and since I'm not mentioning any names at all, I don't want to pick on any person, I think it's hypocrisy. I really think it's hypocrisy. Because if you believe something, you should live by it. If you really think it's true, you should live by it. You don't have it like a little Christmas tree ornament that you put up on the tree and look at it from afar. If you really think that you don't exist, then of course your spouse doesn't exist, girlfriend, boyfriend, they don't exist, children don't exist, friends don't exist. You're just surrounded by a bunch of biological organisms. And none of them are acting, making their own conscious subjective choices. They are just robots. What else can you call it? It's a biological organism, and the brain functions according to the laws of chemistry, physics, biology. And so just for starters, is anyone really willing to live in accordance with that view? Are they really willing to sit back and say, yep, I don't exist at all? At all, just a brain. And moreover, the immediate and I think unavoidable implication of this, contrary to some, I think, some writings that are pure sophistry by philosophers of mind that want to say, yes, you're just a brain and you also have free will, give me a break. Chemicals, electricity operating according to the laws of chemistry and physics, just to speak of them having free will or having any kind of moral responsibility at all is just silly. You don't give moral responsibility to chemicals or to electricity or to cells, even large bodies of cells, any more than you give to a robot or a laptop computer or even my beloved iPhone. You know, they just have no responsibility. So are you willing, really willing to live that? That you don't exist, and neither you nor anybody else has moral responsibility, because chemicals don't have that. Liver doesn't have it, heart doesn't have it, lungs, brain don't have moral responsibility. They're not responsible for anything they do. So, and we don't think animals are morally responsible, and if we're just animals, then why should we think that human beings are morally responsible? So I think it's doublethink, to use George Orwell's term. It's doublethink. While thinking professionally as a scientist, a philosopher, and so forth, we do this spiel of, oh, I don't exist. Oh, it's just like Buddhism. Self is an illusion. And then as soon as you've stopped, you know, thinking professionally, then you're loving your wife, your husband, raising your children, and definitely standing on moral grounds of some sort. And so it's complete doublethink. It's kind of a schizoid thinking. I think it's really profoundly dysfunctional. It's becoming very, very common. It is absolutely not the Buddhist view. So let's look at the Buddhist view briefly. And that is, as we're probing in, this is a preamble to just jumping in and looking at it experientially. I think you've already found that when you seek to identify, to note the characteristics of that which or the person who is controlling the attention, you don't find. You don't find a little Wizard of Oz behind the green veil pulling levers and so forth. you don't find. So then the first conclusion would be, ah, got it. There's no one in charge. There's no one here. Ah, I've just realized emptiness. But then you can do the same thing. And that is, all right, there's no agent, but now is there a tension? Because the idea here is there may or may not be an agent who's controlling attention, right? Releasing it, inverting it. There's an agent. There's the act of controlling, releasing and inverting. And then there's the attention which is being released and inverted, the dog on the leash, right? So you didn't find the self, you didn't find the agent. But now look for attention. Look for attention. Have you ever found attention? Look for it in the same way. You have attention, right? We've been refining our attention skills for 5 weeks now, going on six. Refining attention skills, right? Have you ever found attention? Where is it? I almost had it. It just slipped through my fingers. Where's the attention? Where's the control of attention? Watch. Can you observe the act of controlling? Can you actually observe that? Is that any more or less real than the agent? So the Madhyamaka view actually does not weight emptiness more on the side of the agent than on the act of controlling the attention or on the attention. They're all equally weighted. Each one individually is empty of its own inherent nature, its own intrinsic nature. Each one does exist, but they arise in mutual interdependence. It's like three cards leaning against each other. Take away one and the other two fall. And so it's mutual interdependence, but neither one stands on its own. Not attention, not the act of controlling attention, nor the actor who is controlling attention. The stakes here are very, very high. Because the notion that we just don't exist, there's no free will, is just utter nihilism. And it will lead, if one is very sensitive, like William James, into catatonia, depression. That's the realistic response. And then the materialists come to the rescue with drugs. You know, don't be depressed. Open up, swallow. Do that, freely or unfreely, but just open up and pay at the cashier. That leads to nihilism. That leads to alienation. How could it not? If you look at the people around you and you're just seeing brains, you're going to feel warm? You see anything lovable in a brain? This came up in 1989. You probably know the story, so I'll tell it really, really short. But when you have this whole group of neuroscientists all saying, human beings are brains, human beings are brains, and the Dalai Lama asked the whole group of neuroscientists and psychologists, do you love brains? Do you love brains? You know? And he said it in a very sweet way. I mean, it's the Dalai Lama speaking, so he meant it with utter candor, utter simplicity and clarity. But really, oh, you believe human beings are brains. Do you love brains? As you love your children, your spouse, your friends, you love brains? And at first he said, yeah. And then he said, but really? And I think I was translating there. And I said, really? You really look at a brain? Oh, you sweet little thing. Love you. And then one by one they step down. So, no, I find them fascinating. Yeah, why not? But do I love brain like I love my child? No. Then why do you keep on saying your child is a brain when you love one and you don't love the other? This is doublethink. You don't even believe what you're saying. Why should we believe what you're saying? You really don't believe what you're saying. And yet you keep on saying it. Why do you keep on saying that when you don't believe it and you absolutely refuse to live by it? And if you did live by it, you wouldn't love anybody. You'd be depressed, alien, and if you're really smart, you'd be catatonic. So this could hardly be more different than Buddhism. Right? Now, having said that, there are Buddhist scholars, Asian and Western, who study Buddhist psychology, and they study Madhyamaka, and they study and they debate and they write books and they debate more and they write more, and man, they can whip you when it comes to Madhyamaka. And so full of themselves, man, am I good at Madhyamaka. I really know Madhyamaka. I can beat anybody in Madhyamaka. I so know Prasangika, I can whoop you. And I'll be so happy after I've whooped you, because I'm really good at debating about the non-inherent existence of the self. Complete dissociation. One can be extremely glib, write brilliant words, write commentaries to the great treatises on Madhyamaka, and it doesn't even touch your lived sense of being a person. It's like shooting a BB at a tank. It doesn't even hit the tank. It just goes right over the top. It never connects. Just like the neuroscientist, it says, oh, self doesn't exist, and then it's got a great big enormous ego. And again, I have no neuroscientist in mind, but why couldn't be a neuroscientist be big ego like big Buddhists be big ego? Any may be big ego. It's the dissociation between what one is thinking intellectually and the lived sense of being a human being engaging with other human beings. So study, including of Madhyamaka philosophy, or Dzogchen for that matter, may never touch the target. And His Holiness has written about this really poignantly. He can be extremely sharp, not only smart, but he can have a real blade. And here's one time he used the blade, and that is he was saying, you know, there are people who study Buddhism, and they study, they never really practice. And so they're like a piece of, you remember this analogy? They're like a piece of yak skin, hide. And you just rub a little bit of butter on it. Now, Tibetans, when they wanted to cure yak hide, they do it with yak butter because there's just so much of it. There's just yak butter all over the place. You slip on it, you fall into it. It's just yak butter. Everything smells of yak butter. Yeah, really, yak butter is easy to find in Tibet. And so if you're going to want to make something soft, what's your first thought? Yak butter. And so if you really want to cure yak hide, you take yak butter and you get in there and you work it in and you work it in and you knead it and work it in until eventually that yak butter has saturated the yak hide. And then it's malleable and you can use it for all kinds of things afterwards. It's a really tough hide. You can use it to hold water, hold samba, whatever you like. In contrast, if you take a piece of uncured yak hide and then just slap a little bit of yak butter on the surface of it, go like that, and then say, I'm finished, and put it away, and then come back a few days later to the yak hide and say, I think I want to get around and work with that yak hide again, you'll find that the yak hide has become crispy. The yak butter got on the surface of it, it crystallized, it hardened, and it got into the yak hide enough that if you try to knead it and work with it, the yak hide breaks apart in your hands into little chunks of dry skin. It's good for nothing. The mind that studies a lot, studies Madhyamaka, studies Dzogchen, Mahamudra, Vajrayana, and so forth, and doesn't practice, His Holiness said, is like that dry yak hide. Smeared on a little bit of Buddhist theory on the surface, just enough to make the yak hide useless. If you'd never smeared it on in the first place, you just have a good untamed mind ready to learn some Dharma and maybe practice. But now there's the veneer, the superficial veneer of, I've really studied Dzogchen. I know Dzogchen. I know Madhyamaka. You know, on the surface, and now it makes your mind completely useless. You can't practice Buddhism or anything else. You're screwed. So, final point. Insight into emptiness of the agent, the self, when it's a middle way, not just reinstating the reification of self, the root of all other mental afflictions, not leaping to the opposite extreme, which is so easy, it's like falling backward off of a diving board, into nihilism, into materialism, but finding that slender middle way, when one really sees that there is no inherent existent self here, and yet the self does arise in relationship to actions, the objects of actions and so forth. They're all mutually interdependent. As one gains insight into that, it actually opens the heart. Cognitively, by way of wisdom, insight, it opens the heart to greater empathy, a greater sense of connectedness, because you see now that self that you're grasping onto is separate, autonomous, independent, apart from everyone else, doesn't exist, but you do exist in profound and intrinsic interdependence with all those around you. So therefore, no real barriers of my suffering and your suffering, my joys, your joys, were all arising in mutual interdependence, and the sense of empathy flows out unimpededly. That can give rise to compassion, to loving kindness, to bodhicitta. So this ultimate bodhicitta realization of emptiness then nurtures and sustains relative bodhicitta. In the meantime, of course, the cultivation of the four immeasurables and bodhicitta then nurtures and sustains the realization of emptiness. This fantastic synergy between method and wisdom. Having said all of that, we're coming back to shamatha and the four immeasurables. And that is, if one is leading an egotistical way of life, using one's mind in an egotistical way, that with every action, one's reaffirming, uncritically reaffirming, I am, I am, I am, I'm doing, I'm in charge, like the little engine that could. I'm in charge, I'm in charge, I'm in charge, I'm in charge, I'm in charge. And I'm getting better and better and better at Madhyamaka. I'm in charge, I'm in charge, I'm in charge. And there's no sense, thank goodness I'm not one of those people. I'm in charge, I'm in charge. And, you know, that's not going to go anywhere. So shamatha, on the basis of ethics, is practicing identitylessness, as you all know. Practicing relinquishing control. Practicing releasing the sense of I am, I'm in charge here. Whether or not there is somebody in charge, you're putting that person on leave, a little vacation, every time you follow the breath and just allow the breathing to flow without regulation. Then on a more subtle level, every time you simply observe the mind and allow thoughts and intentions, emotions, desires, memories, fantasies to arise and arise and arise, none of them ego-driven, all of them simply arising independent upon prior causes and conditions, relinquishing control. And then you go right into the very nature of awareness, probing right into the nature of the lived sense of being a person, of an agent, and feeling the freedom of the not finding of such an autonomous agent. In order for the teachings of wisdom, the wisdom teachings in Buddhism, really to strike home, I think we need to live in accordance with them first. Not in a lifestyle or way of using the mind that is completely incompatible. This is why shamatha, this is why samadhi precedes wisdom. And of course, on a coarser and all-important level, why ethics, treating each other with kindness, with decency, courtesy, and so forth, without ego, without bullying, without dominating, exploiting, why this is the foundation. So if the wisdom teachings are truly to transmute, to liberate, they have to be embedded in the cultivation of samadhi, in the broadest sense of the term. And if those teachings are ever to take root and not just be a good session here and there, they have to be embedded in a deeply benevolent, non-injurious way of life. Because anything contrary is contrary to the wisdom teachings. So the stakes are high, I think. So let's jump in. Let's jump in. Let's settle the body, speech, and mind in the natural states. And let your eyes be at least partially open, your gaze gently cast downwards, but without focusing on anything at all, taking nothing as an object. Simply be present. Do nothing at all. Just be. And to just be is to be just aware. And like the sun gradually coming over the horizon, you may be increasingly and vividly aware of the experience of awareness itself, taking no interest in any appearances to awareness. Rest right in the very nature of awareness and know it. And then begin the oscillation, inverting, concentrating, focusing with clarity, withdrawing your awareness from all appearances, right into the very nature of awareness, and then utterly relaxing and releasing your awareness, your attention into space, having no object, just gently, ever so gently, sustaining the flow of awareness, in and out at your own pace, your own rhythm. Presumably you've chosen to follow the instructions of this meditation, to invert and release your attention. But of course it's not sufficient to choose once and then forget about it. You'll just go spinning off into wandering thoughts. You need to make the choice many times over the course of the session and sustain it. Sustain that intention with mindfulness. So now as you invert your awareness, probe inwards upon your experience of being the one who is mindful and the one who continues to decide, to intend, to invert and release your awareness. Examine closely. When you do invert the awareness, do you see anything more or less than when you utterly release your awareness with no object? Is the experience different? Observe closely. there's very little doing in this practice. There is the inversion and the release, and there is the release of thoughts as soon as they arise. That's where the quality control comes in. Introspection still must play a role. Release the oscillation. Let your awareness come to rest in the center. In utter simplicity, and now without doing anything, just be aware of being aware. One of my favorite quips, or little short comments about free will, comes from a conversation someone had, not me, with the Jewish novelist Isaac Bashevis, or Isaac B. Singer, marvelous novelist. I've read a number of his novels a long time ago, loved them. And somebody asked this very sagacious novelist, asked him, "Mr. Singer, do you believe in free will?" And he said, "Yes, of course I do. Do I have any choice?" And rather than treating that wonderful response as a rhetorical question, I'd like to receive it as a real question. And to my mind, the answer is, yes, you do have a choice. You do have a choice. So choose well. Choose well. And if you want to practice Dharma, then you may make the choice to give up attachment to this life and let your mind become Dharma. That's a good choice. Yeah. Olasu, enjoy your day.